WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven and the Wyand Cimbeli Group.
We feel like we all know them both very personally, so I'm going to make it very short. I'm so pleased to introduce both Tony Award-winning musical theater actress Joanna Gleason and, of course, screenwriter and best-selling author Delia Ephron. Welcome.
You have a preferred seat?
Oh, no, I don't. This is from... Which would you rather?
Your choice.
Okay.
Your decision. Good evening. And welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm thrilled to be here to do this for you and about your book. I read the book 2 days ago, and then I missed it, so I went back and I started reading it again.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yes,
oh.
And I don't have... everything is so fast, and everybody has so little time for anything, and I usually pick up a book and just do it in pieces, and then I'm fickle. I'll put it down until somebody says, "Did you read?" And then I have to pretend I've read it, and then I go back and I read it. But I did. I loved it. It's absolutely wonderful. When did you start writing the book? What's the timeline?
It was right after my sister, not right after my sister died. It was in the fall. My sister died in June, and we were so close. I mean, I was 3 years younger, and I'm sure I was the first thing that happened to her that she had no control over. So, and I just never, it was like living in a land without street signs.
Yeah.
I mean, I really didn't know where I was. And I would go into my office in the afternoon around 4, and I was writing not just about us, but about what it meant to be our sisterhood, what it means to be a sister, as well as what it meant to go through that difficult thing and lose her. And,
Did it unlock the rest
yeah,
of the book?
Yeah, it did. It unlocked me is what it did. It just allowed me to move forward in a way that I was having. I mean, that's the great thing about writing and why I'm so lucky to be a writer, mm-hmm. because you can really have a complete analysis. Everything I've ever written about, I've managed to get somewhere with. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be as honest as I could about it. It's complicated. But at the same time, I was on this Jewish book circuit.
Yes. There's a very funny passage about having to kind of pitch yourself or audition. She called it the Jewish Hunger Games. Did I just steal your
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it was. And so I started to write about that, too. I started to write about, because people kept asking me what it was like to be Jewish, and I grew up in a completely non-religious home. But, you know, if you're Jewish, you know that if the Jews get rounded up, you're going to be rounded up,
yes.
too. So I had converted by accident to Christianity twice. So I had a lot of adventures in religion. And so I started, as soon as I sort of wrote about Nora, which took several months, I started to write that. And then I realized I was writing, mm-hmm. you know, a book. That's mm-hmm. when I realized. Mm-hmm.
And it has the shape of the book. Did it come out of a piece, or did you then have the different pieces, sister, husband, you know, mother, dog, and the et ceteras? Did you know the shape of the book at the time?
I didn't know the shape of the book, but I knew those were my major food groups.
Yes.
And that I was going to deal with them all.
Yeah. Well, there's a rhythm to the book that is, and I mean, it's the mark of a great book, too, that it builds. There's an accumulated emotional investment in the book, and just when you think we're off on a lighter tangent, and some chapters are wildly funny, then you round it up in such a way that it's boom, right, a thump right to the heart again, which is
thank you.
Which bespeaks your ability to make us attached to your writing. I attached myself to your writing, you know. I mean, comparisons are odious, as they say, but I was a fan of your sister's work and always felt that there was great instruction to be found in her books, and the arrows would shoot out from her books. This is where to go and how to get this done and what I have learned, and it was funny and perceptive, and I would take notes, as your mother famously said, on her deathbed. But your book, the arrows seemed to shoot in, and there was so much of you and so much that grabbed me in a way where I got caught up in identifying myself with you in a way, an emotional attachment, actually, that was
well,
lovely.
That's what you dream of if you write, you know, that
it's your,
you,
it's a
to
gift.
Connect.
It's your gift.
But the thing about my mother saying that, the most difficult thing I wrote in the book was the piece about my mother. And I had this really amazing mother in that she was a screenwriter when nobody worked, and she thought her four daughters had a destiny to be writers, and this was all just very unusual. But she wore one-liners like armor. Mm. There was just no getting in any way to what was going on. And in the day, she was kind of this remarkable woman in suits who went to the studio. She went to Fox. She worked with my father. And they wrote things like Daddy Long Legs or movies you see in late night television or the Turner classics and stuff. And at night, she went to pieces. She was a terrible secret alcoholic. So that there was the day mother and the night mother. And if you have a parent that is like this, that you don't know who they are. And when this thing she said to my sister on her deathbed, take notes, I mean, that this got romanticized in my family drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, I can't imagine that you're on your deathbed with your daughter and that's what you have to say. I mean, it doesn't make sense. But to me, she said, I hope you never tell anyone what happens here.
So she was the alcoholism wasn't a secret within the family because
no, of course not. And she died of cirrhosis, which is a terrible death. No, it was it wasn't a secret. It couldn't be because their fights were so violent.
Yeah.
I mean, I lived in a very violent home, but in the day you would have thought this was the most enviable home in the world. And I never really wrote about it till this take. First of all, I think you have to tell everyone what happens here, or you'll never get past it. But when it really started to become myth, and of course, it just seemed all wrong to me. Mm-hmm. And the truth was, I was trying to figure out who my mother is, and to this day, on some level, of course, I don't know. And it's so wonderful when you do know who your parent is, you have some real sense of her, but was she the day mom or the night mom, and what caused this? Was it just, you know, a terrible, you know, I don't think it was simply that she had a genetic disposition to alcoholism, but it was very sudden when I was 11, and it was complete. I mean, it was an addiction.
You're the second. You're the second of the
of
the
daughter.
There was Nora, you, and then there was Hallie, and then Amy.
Amy, yeah.
In birth order, I'm the mother of one and the stepmother of three, and the four, they're their own little clan. And for 22 years, you know, I've been tracking them, and there's very definite information and actions land differently upon each of them according to their birth order and how they respond. Do you think your mother was aware that perhaps you were taking in this pain, the psychic pain of this, more than Nora? Did Nora have more armor being the firstborn, I guess?
Well, I think she did, and she was 14 when it happened, and I was 11, and then my sister Hallie was 4 years behind me, and Amy 4 years behind, 5 years behind Hallie. So each of them had a different thing. But I think we all have different parents.
Yeah.
I mean, you're born into a family at a different time in the marriage. You relate differently. We all wish we related the same to our children, but who are we kidding? We really don't.
Yeah.
And some kids you get along with, there's your easy child and your hard child and the child that pulls focus constantly. And so I think in a family, the idea that we all have the same parents isn't true. But I think my mother thought I was my father's, I was
favorite.
My dad's, not his favorite, I don't think, but I was a daddy's girl for sure. Uh-huh. And
so you would betray her by telling what happened.
Yes.
You'd be the one.
That's right. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. But also the second child is a watcher. I mean, of course, I don't know if anyone here has had an alcoholic parent or a parent who is unpredictable. You become a watcher. And because you're always trying to figure out what's going to happen that night. And I can't believe we're talking in such a heavy way so quickly, because I like to make everything funny, but that trip on the turnpike must have turned me dark. Anyway, so, but you know, I think some of my talent as a writer, which is to be observant, comes from living in this house where I was watching all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, birth order fascinates me. I mean, if you are, and the labels that come with it. This is the smart one. This, as if the territory can't be shared.
It's a
common currency, but different flags. This is the funny one. This is the smart one. This is the pretty one. And you're stuck with that.
Yeah, you
even
are.
If you know inside, that's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your true identity.
True.
But you found your voice writing, and you say when you did the 500-word essay, on how to eat like a child? That's when things really started to
develop
for you?
Yeah, my first, well, first of all, I blew my entire 20s.
I love how you say you can what is it, you can waste an entire decade and still have a life?
Yeah, I think that you know that in your 20s, that there's something even romantic about blowing your entire 20s. But when I was 10, I saw a movie called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which is a sort of singing and dancing romantic comedy. And all I wanted, I mean, there's my mother saying, you know, career, 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 right, right, right. And all I want to do is move to the backwoods and marry some horrible pioneer guy and make flapjacks. And I saw that movie like 16 times before I was 20. I saw it once in Madrid. There wasn't even subtitled. I knew every line by heart. And, of course, I mean, I didn't move to the backwoods. I moved to Rhode Island, which
close.
Was almost, yes. Close to here, anyway.
Close to here.
Anyway, so I did this, and I thought I was not going to be a writer. I mean, my sister was a writer from the day she was born, and my parents were writers, and I just thought, well, I can't take this on. And so I didn't think it consciously. I just was obviously making moves where it wasn't possible, and I somehow ended up in the crochet business, all right? This is a really long story, but I had this really terrible boss. I worked at this awful place, and I was just an assistant, and he was always mean. And you know the thing about a mean boss is eventually they're going to be mean to you, which was something I learned in my 20s. And one day, he was being really mean to me, and I said, I quit. And he shouted, "You're flat-chested," I swear. So that left me unemployed and flat-chested. And I mean, what was I going to do? So I went into the crocheting business. And this was like I was crocheting purses and belts for New York department stores. And I was at a party, a party. There was an editor there. And I said in the most pathetic way, I said, "I know you'd never be interested in this, but would you like a book about crocheting?" And he said, "Yes," which, you know, shocked me no end. I still to this day don't know why he did. But I wrote this book, but I didn't think I was a writer. I was just writing instructions. Mm-hmm. But it started to dawn on me, I was about 27 or 8, that, you know, I think this is what I want. And I was terrified to admit it.
Was the resistance because Nora was a writer? Your
folks
were writers?
I think it was just the possibility that I might fail. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, so I said to him, you know, I really think I want to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I don't want you to be a writer."
This is your husband at the time.
My first husband.
Let it be known.
Important. First husband. There. Yeah. And he said, I said, "Why?" And he said, "I don't want you to become famous. Suppose you become famous." And I said, "I promise I won't be famous." And I'm really worried that I've kept that promise. You know, I'm a very faithful type of person. But at that moment, of course, obviously, I had to leave. I mean, if someone wants to crush your dreams, you can't be married to them. So I knew that. And I went to New York, and I had like five. I took all the money. We had a house. And I said, "I'm just going to invest in myself for 2 years, and I'll either be a writer or I'll have to find something else." And I was down to my last $500, which would have been more, except I'd fallen in love with an orange coat. And I wrote this piece called How to Eat Like a Child, about eating. It happened because I was sitting at home eating chocolate pudding my way, which is, the kind you cook, and it has a little skin on top, and I made a little hole, and I was scooping the pudding out, and I thought, I'm eating like a child. So I wrote instructions, because I was good at that, for how to eat like a child. And it was just some sort of New York Times sensation. They said, "More male than Israel." And I was offered a book contract. Yeah. And I looked at that piece, and I thought, oh, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I really knew who I was, and I was over 30.
That's young to me.
Yeah. I heard my voice, my own voice.
Yeah.
I could see it.
And was there encouragement from... Were your younger sisters are writers as well?
Yes, it's interesting because Hallie, I became a writer. Well, I think of it then that when I moved and came to New York, and that was I was 30, Amy became a writer at 39, and Hallie became a writer at 49. Mm-hmm. So they each had a bigger mountain to climb, mm-hmm. and they're all successful published authors.
And they all have different, they will all, how much contact is there? Are you close with your sisters?
Yes, I am close with my sisters. I mean, it wasn't, I'm not as involved as I was with Nora.
You also collaborated with Nora.
Yeah, we were collaborators, and we borrowed lines from each other the way other sisters borrowed dresses.
Yeah. So, you write a lot about about a kind of intimacy that's actually lost when you're collaborating.
Yeah, one of the strange things about, well, I think sisters, just to begin with, sisters, mm-hmm. I don't know if you have sisters, but it's complicated, sisters, because on the one hand, you know everything about them, and on the other hand, you really keep things from them. And I've spent my life turning my girlfriends into perfect mm-hmm. versions of sisters. You know, there's some level that the trust is, because the sibling beast sleeps there always, you know, in the competition, I think that you can't quite be as open with a sibling. And I say that even though Nora and I were always a phone call away and always devoted, but there is, I mean...
But you also don't want ever there to be a rift because you know you're in it, you're joined for the long haul.
Yes, that's also true. And that made it, when we got into trouble on movies, that would be very difficult because we would never want to... We started working together because we trusted each other and Nora needed someone who had her back when she became a director. But when you write and collaborate, you have to have the same investment in the material. The material can't be infinitely more meaningful to one mm-hmm. than the other. Like when we collaborated on my novel, Hanging Up, mm-hmm. that was difficult because it was my novel mm-hmm. and my father had died and it was based on my relationship with my father. So then it became whose father, whose book, whose way. And then we actually ended up asking Diane Keaton to direct because... Right. We thought we needed another person.
Yeah, a tiebreaker.
Yeah, but in the beginning, I mean, with You've Got Mail, and which was all about how much we love books, and there was so much shared mm-hmm. joy.
You talk about the movies. May I read from your book for one
go ahead,
minute here?
Please, this I'm is, honored.
I, so much of this, I just was yelling to the house, which was mostly empty, but I was reading passages of the book out loud. To my dog, you'd be happy.
Yes, that does make me happy.
When you're looking for love, aspiring to love, hoping for love, dreaming of love, movies are where it seems possible. When you're past the falling phase and in the calmer yet more complicated being in love, assuming you're committed to it, the only place you ever fall in love again is at the movies. That is no small thing. The nods of recognition are there. But then once you're on the inside making a movie... Did something happen to when you watched The Sausage Being Made? I mean, is it that those classics will hold up for you forever?
Well, making a movie is just so exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, first of all, for me it's exciting because you have this script and it's words, and then the next thing you know, it's costumes and sets, mm-hmm. and then these actors mm-hmm. come in and they do things that you never even dreamed was possible in that.
In a perfect world.
In a perfect world. Yeah, sometimes you go, oh, my God, what was I thinking?
Things, yes.
Right, yeah. But, and so, I mean, some of my favorite moments in movies were, I mean, this is so crazy, but I mean, Sven Nykvist is one of the most famous cinematographers, and he did all of Ingmar Bergman's movies, and he did Sleepless, and he did our big flop, Mixed Nuts. And even though Mixed Nuts was a big flop, we had all these night shoots, and I would sit with Sven by the camera, and he would tell me why and how he was lighting the shots. And it was, I just could not believe that was happening to me. So movie making, which is so, it's so hard to get a movie made, and mm-hmm. But the actual making of it, before the audience comes in and tells you they don't like it, it is really, it's the testing and everything.
Yeah.
It's just all this talent comes together.
Yes. And nobody sets out to make a bad movie.
That's why
when I'm sitting with my sister's an impatient movie, she'll talk out loud in the movies, which I can't stand it. I want to run. But she'll also leave if she doesn't like a movie. And I keep saying to her, nobody tries to make a bad movie. You have to stay.
Oh, that's interesting. I You know, I think you don't leave because you're an actor.
I do leave. I can't leave. I can't go to the theater and leave because they know, you know. And some usher will tell them, do you know Joanna Gleason left halfway through the movie?
No, that's true.
I can't.
You're in the audience.
Oh, they
and
do
And that's
know.
Terrible, yes. In fact, in the, there's a thing that comes. I didn't know this till Nora and I did Love, Loss, and What I Wore, but there are reports that you get by email
yes.
about what went on. Like any mishaps or events, and they'll always yes. tell you who was in the audience.
Yeah.
They'll always tell you who was.
They do. I had the pleasure of doing Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
I know.
During a blizzard, as I recall.
Really?
There was a blizzard, and one night we outnumbered on stage. We outnumbered the audience.
Oh.
I think there's an equity rule that says you can actually go home if that's true. Or feed everybody.
There should be.
Yeah, there was. But it was great fun. A great piece and great fun. And that was another collaboration with Nora.
That was almost... for me, the most fun of all because, well, first of all, I'd never done theater. And theater is this thing that you know. It's different every single night. You
yes.
think you're going to the same thing the way you are to a movie, but
right.
the actors are different every single night. The audience comes in a mood,
mm-hmm.
and within two lines, you know whether you have a good audience
yes.
or a withholding audience,
a withholding
right?
audience.
Yeah,
yes.
right.
Yes.
And in this case, because it was, I mean, the idea of Love, Loss and What I Wore is that if you ask women about their clothes, they tell you about their lives. So the and really it was 90% women in the audience, which is
right.
terribly exciting because everything in the world in the movies is for men.
Yes.
And here we were having something that was just for women. And the women would really remember their own clothes. And you would mm-hmm. feel, did you experience that? That unbelievable
yes.
sense of connection.
Absolutely, and right away. And I don't think
yeah.
we had a bad night. The piece was so solid. And so identifiable. Any of you see Love, Loss, and What I Wore? Yeah, it was just... And my son, God bless him, my now 34-year-old son, saw it and loved it. Couldn't
oh,
stop
he did.
Talking about it.
That's nice.
You know, yes, and I thought, well, that's rare. He was the only guy in the audience that night.
Yeah, so it would make us really excited. We would get these things, 98% women, and we'd think, yes! You know, and
yes.
then somebody would always say... do you care about the men? And we would say everyone else cares about the men.
Right.
We care about the women.
Right.
So it
right.
was, and that was kind of great fun. But also, I'd never been in rehearsal, which you
mm-hmm.
know all about.
Mm-hmm.
Rehearsal for theater is tremendous fun, and the writer is very unimportant in a movie. A writer, I don't know if you all know this, but as a screenwriter, you are just a gun for hire, and you are fired. Randomly, routinely, again and again. If the actor wants someone else, if the producer, if the studio, if the director, you just get a call.
You're gone. And you're rewritten.
And you're rewritten. And it there's a lot of heart. There are so many angry screenwriters. You know, they have the life. They are the luckiest people
yes.
in the world, and they are angry.
What's the quote you said? I either want to be angry. What was the?
I think Nora had to decide whether she wanted to be angry or to be a director.
Right.
And she chose direct, and I did decide whether I wanted to be angry or be a novelist.
Yeah.
Is what, you know, because I didn't want to be a director. So
didn't want to be a director. Let's talk about cake. Let's talk about bakeries.
Okay.
There's a chapter. Who's read the book? So has anybody read the book?
Oh,
you are in for a treat. And something about books on tape. Have you made a book on tape of this yet? Have you recorded this?
Meg Ryan recorded
oh.
it, and it's the most wonderful audio. It was such a gift to me that she did
Fantastic.
It. And,
Fantastic.
It was very poignant because it had always been Meg, Nora, and me.
Yeah.
And then that day it was just Meg and me.
Oh.
And it was. And oddly, the studio was right where we had done Love, Loss, which was Nora and my last mm. collaboration. So... there was a street corner there where Nora and I would always walk to the corner after we either saw the show
mm-hmm.
or after rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so many I live downtown, she lives uptown, and I have so many memories of saying goodbye on that corner, you know, and I got out for that audio, and
wow.
there was the corner.
Mm.
It was really, and Meg was magnificent. She was just amazing and divine. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, there you go.
That's wonderful. I'm going to get
yeah.
that, too. So I don't have to miss your book anymore. But there's a whole chapter on bakeries.
Yes. Well, I'm obsessed with bakeries. And I never go anywhere in New York that I don't know what bakery is on my route. And fortunately, I have this little disease called discardia, which is the tendency to throw things away. So after a few bites, believe me, if I did not have discardia, I would need to be removed from my house with a crane. Okay. So... I write about bakeries, but it leads me into this whole thing about this just, I hate to say these three words, having it all. And for me, having it all is when what you want and what you have match up. And so that happens extremely rarely in life. Well, it's like an eclipse. And a total eclipse never lasts more than 7 minutes and 31 seconds. Okay? But really, I think that what I've always hated about that idea is that it just assumes all women want the same things. And it thinks about life as some sort of goal, some end point that you gain these things and then, okay, you've got it, which is sort of like high school to me. So, you know, a high school reunion, marriage, children, career, you just check the boxes and, okay, you did that, you succeeded. When really life is a continuum, and sometimes, I mean, I remember being on my own for the first time in New York after I separated from my first husband, and everything was possible, and I had it all. I mean, those days were magical to me. And so and you know when you're reading Goodnight Moon to your child? I mean, that's a moment when you have it all. So I really talk about that, but of course, so it's also impossible to have it all, you know, because every choice you make makes some choices more possible and some choices less. So the only place I can have it all is at a bakery.
It's at a bakery.
Yeah. And yeah, not only that, even though there's no more than all, I can have more. So
I love
bakeries.
You love bakeries, but going into your having it all, which is what you were just talking about here, it was one of my favorite passages in the book. Personally, I believe that having it all can last longer than the 7 minutes from the eclipse. It might be a fleeting moment drinking a cup of coffee on Sunday morning when the light is especially bright. I mean, you go on, and everything you were saying, we've all had some version of, it's just a little bliss moment like that.
Yeah.
That we have to start paying attention, more attention to the fact that we're having them.
Yeah, you know? I think it's about how you live your life. I don't think
But it's also about observing, and the fact that when you take note of something, you own it. In a way.
That's true.
Your mastery of observing these things gives you ownership of them, which you
Thank
then share
you.
With us and make you made me realize if I just pay attention and start to just annotate my life and realize I have the oh my God, there was that bliss moment. There are bliss moments all the time in the midst of such chaos and craziness.
No, it's true. It's true. I'm obsessed with tennis, of course, so I'm always happy during the US Open, but there was a Nadal Djokovic match.
Yes.
I don't know if anyone saw that final. I mean, please. We all had it all then. You know, that moment in front of the TV. Yeah. You know, just watching a great show that you're in love with. Yeah. I'm in love with this French series on Netflix called Spiral. Have you seen it?
No, and I'm going to.
Oh, my God. It's incredible. But just be sure to turn the subtitles on or you won't know what's going on. Anyway, you know.
Bliss.
Yeah.
Bliss in unexpected places and at unexpected times.
Yeah.
I mean, does life, do you have a kind of timeline where things are before losing your sister and after losing Nora? Or is now time a different, has it reset in some way?
No, I think for a long time I've realized that you can never be focused on whether something's a success or a failure. And you know this for yourself when you go into a play.
Yeah.
You absolutely have no control over that. So all you have is process. Mm-hmm. And process is just the day, right? And it's about how the write for me. It's how's the writing going that day? Am I getting somewhere with it? Is it? It's just that's the only thing I know I can own. Mm-hmm. Everything else is in the hands of
the random,
other people.
The random gods.
So
who will rewrite you endlessly?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And fire you? Yes.
Or I mean, you can be in a play that's your absolutely favorite part you've ever done, and then the critics will say
yes. I don't read reviews. You don't read reviews either, do you?
No, I don't. I don't.
Good. because this is the thing, because the good ones are never good enough, right? And the bad ones are just wrong. So.
Oh, the bad ones are arrows in my heart, and the good ones bounce off like hits at a Vegas casino or something. You know, but you're right. They never do quite. What your fantasy is never there.
That's right.
But it also just keeps you. I think you always have to look inside for what's true. And rather than outside, and that just keeps you focused properly.
Well, and if you've had the most amazing time with your castmates and the audience, and you go and you love being there and signing in and doing the show, how can you let one person take that away from you?
Yeah.
As if it's all a lie, you know, and not true.
I know. It's a horrible thing.
It's a horrible thing, but it's a fact of our lives. But
so often I read something I fall in love with, and then I see a review and it isn't good, it makes me completely insane.
Well, they're just wrong. I'd like to open it up to any questions, if any of you have questions for Delia. That's a good, it's a good time to start. Who would like to say anything? Ask anything? You know you have questions. Yes.
Yes.
A man, one of the 2%.
Could you talk a little bit about moving between writing screenplays, writing plays, writing novels?
I'm supposed to repeat the question because there's an audio thing.
Yes.
Moving between writing screenplays, novels for the theater.
Well, first of all, any material kind of tells you what it is in some way. And with Love Lost, which was a book that, a wonderful book by Eileen Beckerman, Nora and I knew immediately that it was an evening in the theater, like the vagina monologues, but no vaginas. And it wasn't a movie, it wasn't something else. And so I always think stories come to you, but my last novel, which I felt I could do as a screenplay, I knew was too when the story came to me, and it actually came in a dream, which has never happened to me before, I started to write it, thinking, oh, this is a movie. And then I thought, no, I'll lose it if it's a movie. I'll just lose it. It's too precious. And so I wrote it as a novel. So I always think that the most precious stories I have to tell, I will make into novels. And the thing is that movies pay better. So that you can sort of think, oh, I'm so sick of this cheap old publisher, I think I'm going to go and make some money in the movie. So then you do that, and then you think, I just miss my wonderful, divine, fabulous publisher. I have a wonderful publisher, actually, on this. And yes, I love them. I just want to say that, Blue Rider
it's
Press.
Now
I
public.
Love them beyond belief. But, you know, you get this thing where you start banging around back and forth. But I decided that I wanted to, from when I started in books, and I always promised myself I would always go back to books. And I actually was very practical. There were times when I thought I need to learn to write an essay. I need to learn to write a novel. I set goals, and I think it gave me much more longevity, because if one thing wasn't working out, I could move.
Another question. Next question. Yes. Yes.
Are there any screenplays in the making?
And will you collaborate again with Meg Ryan?
We have some little thing we're talking about, but we just started talking about it, so that would be wonderful. But I do have a screenplay that just got a director last week.
Ooh.
And it's based on my friend Susan Thomas's life. She had this really extraordinary romantic life. Well, it's a little long to tell, but it involved going to Russia when she was in 1964, when you were trailed by the KGB, and she left the guard and got on a bus with real Russians and fell in love with a Russian and had a passionate affair in 3 days. And it's the story of what happens after that. It's an amazing story. And so that's going on. And then I have my pet psychic movie going into its 10th year in development.
Wrote about this in the book.
Yeah, I did.
Yes,
I
this is wonderful.
Yeah, is where I got this idea, was that my first beloved dog died, Daisy. And I was doing nothing but watch the pet psychic on television. I don't know if you ever saw her. And then I was watching Crossing Over with John Edwards. Did you ever see that? I was addicted to that show. I went to it, too. And I've never been anywhere so amazing as that. I mean, I couldn't believe what he did.
It was amazing,
and there was total silence in that room for the 3 hours that he was there. Anyway, so of course I was in some sort of crazy state, and I decided that I would write a woman who talks to animals falls in love with a man who talks to the dead. Only thing is, she can do it, and he can't do it. Okay, so of course he thinks that she's a fraud, and she thinks he's for real. Okay. But the thing is, he has a dog, and the dog falls in love with her and rats him out. So, okay, it has not been made, and I think it may have a director. I've told you the second act breaks, so you probably don't even need to see it.
Yes? Could you talk a little
bit about your daily habits and
Yes, talk about your daily habits and discipline.
Yeah, my day. I you can't be a writer without work habits. And that was the first thing that I learned. When I sold my book, I had no habits. And so I got involved with the craziest guy in the world that anyone walking down the street would spot for a crazy guy, you know, and so that I couldn't even think. And my shrink, of course I had a shrink, said to me, you have to learn to be a writer. You have to sit. He told me how to get rid of the guy, which was very helpful. But then he said, you have to sit down at your desk every morning at 10. You can't get up till 12. You have to sit back down at 2, and you can't get up till 4. Now, I mean, we didn't have internet, so it was a lot easier to do then. But he said, you don't need to write, but you have to stay there. And it turned me into a writer. It just took the question, will I write, out of my day. You can't be anything without discipline. You can't be an actor. You can't be a writer. But it's just about, can you glue your butt to the chair? Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
That's true. Yes.
Yes.
The experience about that you wrote about.
That
about
was
the bank.
Yes, that's it. That's yeah, in the collection. Yeah. Well, the banks didn't say anything about it, of course, but it went viral. That piece. That piece was the most. It was just a sensation because everybody hates their bank, and it was just all about the fact that, you know, I get my savings account and I've made like $1 interest, and I'm being charged $35 for service. So my pathetic amount of savings is going down, the staggering amount. And then when I go to the bank and I say, what's going on here? They say, and I prove to them that I have more money in a CD, which they, of course, said, we forgot to bundle that in, they said. I then said, well, reverse the charges. And they said, well, we can't reverse it here. You have to go to a bank on the Upper West Side that I didn't even have an account at. And so I had to take 3 subways to get, you know. So, I mean, the whole thing was hysterical, really hysterical. And I loved writing that piece. I love it when something really crazy happens. Right now I'm absolutely furious at these bicycles. But I seem to be the only one in New York who hates the bicycles.
No.
I think we should all be wearing helmets when we walk around the city.
Yeah, they obey no rules of the road.
No. Yeah. You step off a street corner. But, yeah, you know... Yeah. We don't obey either. That's what makes it so tricky,
yes,
right?
You know? This is also. Right. But did you see Nicole Kidman got absolutely clocked, laid out by a paparazzo? If that's
she
the singular.
Did?
Yes, a guy on a bicycle trying to get close to her. She was walking into a hotel and mowed her right down. She's fine.
I missed that.
She's fine. She got up. She went to Fashion Week. She's fine.
She is, but no,
but
it can
she got,
really.
But she got. Oh. And then they're a menace. They're up on the sidewalks and they're running the lights and life
I
in the
know.
City. You take the subway.
I love the subway. Well, I wish there was a subway to New Haven.
Yeah.
I would have been here on time.
Yes, there's a site. It runs above ground, though. It's going to
yeah, yeah,
Metro
yeah.
North. Yes.
To what extent did being a child something or a passive?
I need to just repeat it for the audio. This is a question about being the child of an alcoholic, and is there a point where you're out from under it or you have a kind of observation about it that starts to give you some distance from it?
There's so much about that, really. I mean, it's a lifetime of anxiety. I really think that you're never a very relaxed person, and you're always expecting that if you're looking left, it's coming at you from the right, and you can't look 2 directions at once. And I think is a real, it leaves a lasting impression of not feeling safe. But someone said to me the other day, oh, you know, she knew... This person knew Nora and said she had been so generous and that I seemed generous too. And how could that be if I had these parents? And I realized that if you're the child of alcoholic, the problem isn't really whether you're a nice person. It's whether you believe you're entitled to have a nice person love you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, for me, I think when I married the husband I'm married to, Jerry, that was, to me, a turning point, that I had accomplished this thing that I felt I had no preparation for.
That's so. It's so interesting because that can come upon you. It came to me, I was already 40.
Uh-huh.
With that moment where you land in your life with both feet and you just say, oh, I cannot, you can't see, I can't see what your destiny is ahead of you, even though I have a team of psychics and numerologists and astrologers.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I
can't wait to hear.
Oh, my God. Even a small medium. I have a small medium. She's 4'8". She's a small medium. But that if you look in the rearview mirror at some age, you look back and you say, oh, I see, I see, I see, I see. All the places I sabotaged or didn't feel entitled or all that stuff.
Right, or pick up. I had the same shrink. He said that thing across a crowded room.
Yes.
You know that when you spot that, that's psychology, not chemistry.
Interesting.
And then until you really change your head around, you're just always spotting. You know instantly who's bad for you, and you go right toward it. So I think, you know, that. And I think just writing made me help me get confident and stuff like that.
Would the old you show up in your writing, or the you you'd like to discard or renovate show up and then you rewrite, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, that's interesting. No, but you know how you take awful things and then you decide maybe they weren't so awful,
yes.
Which is probably delusional? because I had this happen to me where my mother sort of, there was a break, really, in my life when my mother, it got very dark after I was 11. I think of it as a sweet spot now for my work where I can go, just the thing you were talking about, I can go very dark and then go funny. And it's like the two parts of my life. So I think I've worked it into my writing as something that I value.
The best use of, it's your emotional material, and it's the best use of it, too.
That's right. Well, I think both acting and writing allow you to make use of things that happen to you.
Yes, absolutely. Another question. What about, yay, the West is represented. She's talking about Nora's hidden cookbook, and will it ever be made public?
You know, honestly, first of all, I don't know if that would ever happen, but there were things that we all felt were part of the family rather than part of the public. And one of the strangest things about Nora's death for me was that she was my sister. I wasn't thinking that she was the loss for all the people of the world that she was. And so there was there's public ownership when someone is given that much to the world. And that's completely different than the grief you experience privately. So there were things, I'm sort of glad you asked that because it's such that cookbook came up in our minds as something that was ours. And not just for me, I mean, other members of the family felt this way because so much of what she was wasn't ours, seemed to be owned by other people.
My idea is to donate the proceeds to charity.
Well, of course.
Another question.
It has very good stuff in it. I really like her lemon square. I don't want to make you jealous
square.
Or anything, but yeah.
Does she make a chicken soup? Nora said to me once, chicken soup does not cure a cold. Chicken soup is what actually gives you the cold. I've been afraid of chicken soup.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she terrorized me.
Thank God she never said that to me.
Yeah, there was a hand over here. Yes.
Did you enjoy the mayoral primary, and what are your feelings?
Oh, did you enjoy the New York
mayoral primary? No. Well, of course I did because, you know, of yes, Anthony. And I wrote about that in the bakery piece, how I won't tell you. It's in the book, how about my feelings about Anthony and having it all. But I did not know who I was going to vote for till I literally walked into the voting booth, and that's never happened to me before.
How did you write dialogue with Nora? Did you go back and
forth? Well, no. Sometimes you might read something, but not really. We had to outline first, and we would usually, one of us would make a pass at the scene, and then the other would rewrite the scene. And it would just depend on who'd been... We took turns at the computer if we were getting ideas, and then so we tried to equalize everything out like that. And then with email, it got easier because sometimes we didn't need to be in the same room. I mean, I remember with Sleepless in Seattle. I remember it was all around the kitchen table where we just kept going over the scenes and trying to make them better and more fun and more interesting, and that was very give and take. But mostly it would be, you try it, or one of us would send the other something. I cannot get this. Please, you do it. And that was the magic of collaboration.
Your other two sisters are novelists, Hallie and Amy?
Yeah. Amy writes novels, and she writes these amazing period novels. One of them is A Cup of Tea, and it's wonderful. It takes place in the 30s. It's very beautiful. And Hallie writes some mysteries. She writes a mystery a year. She's really prolific.
I think I've slipped in between the two of them at Beverly High.
Oh, really?
I think so.
I forgot that you went to Beverly.
Yes, we went to the same school, but we were 2 years old. I think Hallie was 2 years older than me, then Amy is 2 years younger, I think. We had heard of the Efron...
Really?
Name. Yeah, because your parents were... I grew up with a lot of... my folks took us to the theater a lot, and I had been raised in New York till we moved to California. And so there was the theater, and there was an appreciation of movies in the theater. So your parents were in a kind of... higher up in the pantheon.
Oh,
really? Yeah. And so we knew, and then we knew that the Efron girls were there at Beverly High.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I just cannot figure out how chicken soup gives you a cold.
I couldn't. And I actually wrote Nora. I was in California. I had a terrible cold, and I emailed her, and I said, my mother's offering me chicken soup. What do I do? She said, eat the soup. Just eat the soup, she said.
Oh.
It's too late. Eat the soup. Yeah.
Well, you know,
I need to just condense the question very briefly.
Yes. Okay.
Or maybe I hope this mic picked it up, but this is a lovely lady who's one of nine children, eight girls and one boy, and was talking about how do you, within a family, you talked about not wanting to best Nora, but wanting to differentiate yourself.
I talk about that in the book because I think it's an important thing. I mean, famous people suck more energy out of a room. And how do you live around that? And that is what happened, why I think How to Eat Like a Child, when I wrote it, was so important to me. Because at that point, I didn't really know where she started and I ended. I mean, she was 3 years ahead, and she was so definite, and she was so bossy, as you can imagine. And we were, and devoted. So I think that it was, until I wrote that, I went, oh, I knew no one else would write that. I knew. And then I very carefully, in my life, have always tried to look, I was never cool and hip, I just want to say that, ever. So I was never in danger of going out of style, all right? But I always felt I had to look inside for what was true. And if you do that, those stories are only your stories. That your writing is your fingerprint, your whatever in your family were the gifts. The way each of you do it is your own fingerprint. And that's your job in life, is to come to some understanding of what your identity is. And it can be harder if you have a sister like Nora. I mean, because they seem born with a sense of their own identity and destiny. And if you're not, if you're the kind of person that, like, as I am, you know, that needs to kind of try things and doesn't always know, and, I mean, it can be harder.
Well, at a point you were saying, I want to be like her, which is how can I be me?
I was just very clear that I didn't think that much. But when I wrote that thing, I thought, oh, I understand this. And I knew when we collaborated on movies that I had to continue to write books because I knew I had to have my own voice, that if I looked back and my voice had been, you know, sucked into hers, that would have been hard. And I have to tell you, this is so weird, but at Nora's memorial service, which was were you there, Joanna?
No.
Oh, it was, as you can imagine, a big event, and I had to speak, and I was very nervous about it. I was concerned, and I was completely blotto. I mean, I was so distressed just about her death. And Martin Short is speaking, and he's quoting her. He's saying, you know, he said like three funny things she said, and he says that she said, hazelnuts is what's wrong with Europe, okay? All right? And everyone laughs, getting a big laugh even at a memorial service, very important in my family, okay. So my husband like jabs me, that's your line, you know. And of course it wasn't, I realized that she'd just been dining out on it, and here we were, I'm totally devastated and the sibling beast is alive and well, you know. I mean, and that was just, that's what it is, that's life. No, you know what happened? I sat there thinking, am I just going to let it pass, you know? And I had this whole thing written out, you know, and I got up, and just as I was about to speak, I said, you know that line about hazelnuts in Europe is mine. And I got a huge laugh. So I was totally happy, right? So for 1 second. But, you know, no, I did not let it pass.
Anything? Any more questions? Yes, in the back, sir.
I had seen that movie. Well, I'm a huge lover of old films. I mean, love, and I think The Shop Around the Corner is one of the greatest movies ever, and a perfect film. And it's very dangerous to do anything to a perfect film. But because The Shop Around the Corner is about two people who are pen pals. They work in the same store, and they hate each other in life, and they're in love in the mail, all right? And it happened that now we had email. And so suddenly there was a reason to remake that movie. And that was why we did it, because there was actually a way to rethink the movie in a modern sense. And you couldn't, by the way, movies are all about stakes and who, are there enough stakes for the leading character? I mean, did things get hairy enough for them? And if they worked in the same place, it wouldn't work. We had to have, at that moment in time, the gigantic stores like Barnes & Noble were putting the independent booksellers out of business. So we also had a situation where he could be putting, not only were they in love in the mail and didn't know it, but he was putting her out of business in life. It wasn't just that they, you know, worked in a similar field. So we had a number of reasons to make it, and of course we had Tom and Meg, you know, and as great a romantic combination as really was in. Mm-hmm. It's Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan. Margaret Sullivan.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But there is a scene in that movie, The Shop Around the Corner, which is identical in our movie. It was identical in the movie In Between. There was a Judy Garland musical made out of it with Van Johnson. That same scene is identical, and I bet you it was identical in the original play. I mean, sometimes someone writes a story that is so charming, so enchanting, so remarkable that people just retell it. But that scene was as perfect when it was first written.
Which scene was it?
It's when he goes and he looks in the window
at
the cafe,
oh, yes.
And he finds out from his friend that it's her.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful in your movie, but it's heartbreaking in your movie and in the
it's
the
great
Jimmy Stewart
in the shop
too.
Around the corner.
Yeah, no, it is wonderful. Anything else? Any other questions? Yes. This book, Sister,
oh, it's
Mother,
a, oh,
Husband,
Sister,
Dog.
Mother, Husband, Dog. My, it is, yes, she's, that's the book that she's
is
read.
It available yet, or is it, has it
yes, been? It is. It's just out now. I just saw some last night.
Fantastic. Yes, just a couple more questions. Yes.
Yeah, you've written about your hair.
Oh.
Is it a family?
Has my sister written about her hair?
She spoke about it, yeah.
Well, don't you think it's the most important thing in the world? I mean,
don't you have
any surprise to you?
Yeah.
No, I do this thing on Twitter called the hair report, because I think that no one cares about the weather. They only care what the weather's going to do to their hair. So I built my entire meager Twitter following on the basis of the hair report, because women just, you know,
it's in here.
There's a chapter about the hair report in here.
Pick a hairstyle and stick with it. Is that the motto?
Yes. Right. What?
Sorry? Your sisters also?
Well, everyone I know. If my sisters are not, there is something wrong, and I have to talk to them about it.
Yeah. All right. One more question. Who's got a question? I thought I saw another hand. Yes. How do you get a publisher from out of the blue?
Well, it was easier when I started, because print was everything, and it was easy to get. Books were thriving, and you know, and now, of course, because people don't speak anymore, they only write and text, everyone's a writer in a different kind of a way. So it's very weird that we now have everyone writing and no outlets for their writing. But I think you have to know what your stories are. You have to get discipline, and you have to start there before you go to the world and think it's going to happen. If you want to be a screenwriter, I mean, you really should be out in Los Angeles. You cannot be a screenwriter and just sit at home wherever. I mean, that's a business, and you've got to work it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yes.
You've got to work the business and make contacts and everything. But I always think that connections help, and I mean almost everyone's got one if they really think about it. But there are ways to get attention, and there are ways to, you know, you send 15 pages to an agent and a cover letter and ask if they want to see more. And I know people who've sold their books that way.
It's and not you have eight siblings. You must be connected to somebody.
Right, right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'm not Oprah, and I don't have a book club, but I cannot recommend this book more highly. You'll be spending time with a new friend, and when you put it down, you're going to miss her, and then you'll get the book on tape, and you'll hear it all over again while driving safely in your cars. And thank you. I'm so honored to be here.
I am so honored that you did this with me.
No, it's just beautiful, and I'm happy to see you, and thank you all for coming tonight, too.
Thank you.